Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy and the War Room podcast editor. Today we're going to try out a different format for the podcast, and I've asked three of my colleagues to join me in the studio for a roundtable discussion about the national security strategy, which was just released by the Trump administration on the 18th of December. Professionals across the national security community await the release of this document, especially in a new administration, as it signals priorities for the national security and foreign policy agenda, and often sets the tone for ongoing conversations about defense, security, and international relations more broadly. So it seemed appropriate to ask a number of War College faculty members to read the document closely and to come together to have a frank and unscripted discussion about the national security strategy. So what I see around me at the table is lots of notes on this like 55-page document. So if you hear a little more paper shuffling than normal, it's because there is actually quite a bit of paper shuffling happening so we can find specific things. But with that, let me introduce the participants in the roundtable. So for myself, in addition to cajoling people to record podcasts, my own work focuses on social, cultural, and rhetorical approaches to the study of national security. And my guests today also have a wide range of experience and expertise. And I'll introduce each of them briefly and let them say hello. First is Dr. Mark Duckenfield. He is the chair of the Department of National Security and Strategy and a political scientist with expertise in the economics of national security.
Well, thank you for having me, Jackie.
Happy for you to be here. Next, we have Colonel Michelle Ryan. She is part of the JAG Corps of the U.S. Army and is the director of the National Security Policy Program here at the War College.
Thanks, Jackie. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. And finally, we're joined by Dr. Richard Lackament, who is dean of the School of Strategic Land Power, and he is a retired Army strategist and holds a PhD in public and international policy.
Thanks, Jackie. Pleasure to be here.
Great. So I think the question I want to sort of open up with is one about how normal or how mainstream we think this document is. So national security strategies have been published since the Reagan administration, so we have quite a few to compare this document to. And in the introduction, the president suggests that this national security strategy is a departure from ones that we've seen in the past, right? That this charts, we are charting a new and very different course, is on the on page one. And so, Dr. Duckenfield, let me ask you, how different of a course do you think this national security strategy is charting?
Well, I think there's a very clear difference between the document itself and Donald Trump's rhetoric and indeed many of his actions. The document itself is largely consistent with previous efforts, and even the primary feature that Donald Trump highlights, the focus on economic security, is one that harkens back 30 years in the first national security strategy. Ronald Reagan highlighted a healthy and growing U.S. economy as a vital American interest. Bill Clinton in 1994 put the bolster America's economic revitalization as a core interest. And just in 2015, Barack Obama's letter declared that America's economic strength is the foundation of our national security and a critical source of our influence. All of these hearken very much to Donald Trump's national security strategy. And so in that regard, I see what is promised as new is not especially new. There are occasional rhetorical flourishes that make it a slightly more enjoyable read, if you will, than some of the previous bureaucratic enterprises. But again, it's a bureaucratic document produced by a large bureaucratic staff, and so it should be unsurprising that many great continuities are present.
Okay. What about you? This is Dr. Lackament.
Yeah, I would agree with Mark about some of the key. I think the continuity struck me as more significant than the differences when you read the whole document. However, there are some key framing devices that I think really stood out to me, and I would have cited the same thing about economics as being a priority, as one of the main continuities. And by the way, I would note, Jackie had noted that we've only had national security strategies going back to the late 1980s. I mean, this is one of these gold, water, nickels elements
right.
requiring this. And if I were to look at some of the key themes that have held up is we had the Soviet Union at the time in the Cold War, and there was a strong sense of sort of America leading the community of like-minded democracies is the phrase in this particular 2017 version, but essentially leading the free world, leading the liberal democratic community. That theme has been fairly consistent since the very first of the national security strategies, and frankly going back to the earliest days of the American Republic when it comes to foreign policy. And we've always had some version of promulgating our values as universal and seeking others to work with and encouraging others to become more like us. That's still there, in addition to sort of the key economic component. But I think one of the things that struck me about this one compared to the ones that have come out since 1987 is usually allies take a more prominent role in terms of where they are in American national security strategy. And really, I just kind of, looking back to the 2015 one, if you looked at that very first vital interest of the United States, and in the 2017 one, the way it's phrased, pardon me for just a moment, make sure I get the wording exactly right. The way they phrased it in 2017 is to protect the American people, the homeland, and the American way of life. And then the focus there is on ways, it really is focused on the United States. Same in the second one about economic prosperity, heavily focused on exactly what the United States, what we can do internally to take care of ourselves. Whereas in 2015, and this is similar to some of the other national security strategies, the very first vital interest that is identified is the security of the United States, its citizens, and U.S. allies and partners. And so that was up front as part of who we're securing, whereas in this one it moves more into the third of the major priorities, which has more to do with preserving peace through strength. And then allies and partners come out as
right.
a key contributor to how we preserve peace and strength.
Sure. So I think that's a great sort of observation about how even similar goals might be framed differently and prioritized differently. Colonel Ryan, what about you? What were your initial impressions about continuity and change?
I was struck by the amount of similarities, and though there may have been some changes in the wording, and for instance, advancing American influence is identified as the fourth priority, it's really about American values, and that comes out as you get into the text. So while there may have been some changes, we do see consistency there. Nevertheless, as you dig into the document, particularly when you start looking at signaling about how we're going to accomplish it, there's a big emphasis on returning to American domestic sources of strength and ways forward and reinvestment in American domestic economy in a way that at sometimes might feel a bit heavy-handed in that we hear it repeatedly, but certainly that's been something that, you know, this administration has prioritized from the time they began running for office, you know, continuing through the inauguration and today.
Sure. So it sounds like broadly we see some large continuities, and this struck me as I was reading as well, that this to me is sort of right down the middle of mainstream American sort of grand strategy and foreign policy. I don't see major grand strategic adjustments here. The identification of potential threats, basically North Korea, Iran, China, Russia, and then the sort of plus one of international terrorist organizations or organized crime. Those seem to be right in line with the way American foreign policy has sort of been operating in the last couple of decades. Again, security, prosperity, American values. And again, the rhetoric changes. We don't use the word American values so much as American influence and principles is the term that they use here. But this doesn't actually strike me as a strategic adjustment. Certainly, it's not responding to a strategic shock, although it is maybe trying to position itself in opposition to the previous administration in particular. But we've also noticed, and I think we've started to talk about some of the differences, and I think there are some key differences, both things that are added in and taken away. So Richard, over to you. What do you notice there?
Well, let me highlight one other sort of continuity I think is something to pay attention to going forward, and that is when we talk about strategy in our framework here at the War College, we tend to talk about ends, ways, and means. And in previous strategies, the idea, or critiques, most people notice that this is typically a fairly high-level vision document.
Right.
Tends to be very focused on ends. And critiques have said it needs to do, we should do more to identify the link between ways and means to achieve those ends. And I would say that this one sort of fits the mold in that it's strong on ends and a set of aspirations and vision, vague on ways. Now, this is where you sort of see them tease out, and they spend a lot of time saying there are priority actions in many of the sections that they identify. But the priority actions generally are not backed up, going to the last part, by any means identified. And so the thing to sort of highlight going forward is you're looking at usually this time of year also, or the early years, we're looking for the president's budget proposal, and that's when now they'll try to line up what are the dollars in particular that go with the different priorities of the government. And that's a place to look for where do they start lining up resources, the means, against some of the ways and given the end. So in that regard, there is some continuity. But the end of sort of America first as the catchphrase, I am not kind of aware of any American national security strategy that didn't implicitly, if not explicitly, have America first. So I'm not sure there's as much of a change there. But in the ways, I think if you look, there is, as Michelle identified, a little more emphasis on what the United States can do internally, more focused on the American people, the American economy, American military, and others in the international community are a little more instrumental as opposed to central to, I think, where the United States thought of itself as the leader of the free world, whereas here it sees itself leading, but the manner in which it interacts with the external community is a bit different.
It seems a definite contrast to the phrase which President Obama took a lot of flack for, right, which was leading from behind. And this puts America, the United States, sort of firmly at the front of the line. Michelle, you had...
Yeah, I was following up on Richard's comments about, you know, this document continuing to be an emphasis on the ends, and then where do the ways and means fall out. And in fact, I wrote down as part of my notes in here, and by here I mean in the national security strategy, how do we pay for all this goodness? And that may be at the forefront of my mind, because as we sit down to discuss this, we've just had new tax legislation pass through Congress that is going to cut our revenue, and yet there are calls for increasing spending on border security, increasing spending on, you know, the military.
Increasing the size of the military,
yes. Right,
which doesn't come at low costs. So there's all sorts of questions about implementation, and I think a common critique of the national security strategy is, as you said, it's just a list of good stuff. It's a list of things that we like. Mark, you're the economist in the group. What do you think about all of this?
Well, the thing that strikes me about this, and again, it's a continuity with the previous documents from the Bush administration and the Obama administration, is the one area where they often differ substantially is not their foreign policy, but their domestic policy. The Obama administration has included healthcare reform as part of its national security objectives. The Bush administration had regulatory and tax reform as part of his, and as the current national security strategy document puts it, as part of its efforts to rejuvenate the domestic economy, the priority actions are, and this is, you know, a lot of this is straight part and parcel out of the partisan program, right? Reduce regulatory burdens, promote tax reform, improve infrastructure, campaign promise of Donald Trump, reduce the debt through fiscal responsibility, support education and apprenticeship programs. Well, it's not entirely clear how the big spending items can then be squared away with reducing the debt, but you can see that a Democratic administration would probably have had some elements that would be different from that. You also see it in the energy area as well. So the means that you put towards the broader ends of the document, and indeed the ways I think that in some cases are implicit, are the substantial differences we see
on the domestic side. And it strikes me too that there could be somewhat of a disconnect between the executive and Trump's national security team and the Republican controlled Congress in terms of priorities about spending and tax reform and exactly what that means. So you mentioned energy security, and in this document, it's energy dominance, right? So this seems to be one of the key differences in the document. What do we make of the section on energy dominance?
Well, I mean, it's entitled Embracing Energy Dominance. It does seem to suggest there's a pullback from climate policies, which are referred to as the anti-growth energy agenda. But at the same time, there's an embracing of all forms of energy, not simply the hydrocarbon-based ones, but nuclear, renewables, anything of that nature, and emphasis on continuing to try to reduce barriers, promoting exports, and then, curiously, attaining universal energy access for the United States, which is a sort of an odd way of phrasing it, or not simply for the United States, but for everybody. And presumably universal energy access in the realm of nuclear wouldn't apply to Iran or North Korea, for instance. That would have some clear security implications. Seems to be a very clear industrial policy, if you will, as well, is at play. There's also a consideration for the national security innovation base, which I think is the first time we've seen that phrase, which is a linking together of academia, national laboratories, the private sector, the sort of thing that could contribute to energy innovation, but innovation in a whole host of other areas. But it seems to be a very state-coordinated effort, and there are frequent mentions throughout about the U.S. government needing to monitor trends and steering resources in the right direction, which is a slightly unusual route, at least for a Republican administration.
Great, thanks.
If I might just add to play out that a little bit, it occurred to me one of the other differences that I don't think we've highlighted yet is that in approach to trade. I mean, usually the national security strategies of previous years, and I mean by both the party administrations from both parties, tended to have a strong emphasis on trade relationships, and in particular trade pacts and such. So this one still emphasizes trade, and it's very heavy on fair trade, right, and reciprocity.
As opposed to free trade, which has been the sort of clarion call for a couple decades.
Right, and includes sort of explicit, and just looking back to 2015, when obviously President Obama had included very explicit reference to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and building trade pacts like that, and reference to allies included in some of these multilateral trade pacts. Trade agreements, whereas this particular one, National Security Strategy, when it talks about trade, it talks about bilateral trade, right, and much more focused on, and less reference, if any, I don't recall any reference to any of these sort of collective trade pacts, although there are some references to the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund, some of the global institutions.
And there are also, I guess, the idea of U.S. influence, the idea that the U.S. Should have influence commensurate with its contributions to budgets and its contributions to the sort of international community, which is a departure from how most of these organizations work in terms of one country and one vote and things like that. I think this idea of bilateral trade agreements being able to substitute for the big multilateral pacts is certainly something we've been hearing the sort of Trump surrogates talking about a lot, that the United States can accomplish the same things as, say, would be the results of the TPP through bilateral agreements rather than requiring multilateral agreements, which may not be advantageous in all respects. So climate change has been one of the key things that people have pointed out that sort of drops in significance here. It is environmental change, I think, is the phrase that this document uses, and it's embedded. It doesn't have its own heading. It doesn't have its own section. Certainly that sort of goes against the previous administration and also against what some of our own DOD leaders have said, who have called climate change one of the greatest threats to American national security. What other elements did we notice that sort of maybe come in or fall out? Are there other specifics that are worth noting here?
I'll highlight that. We mentioned the threats, and although the idea that China and Russia and Iran and North Korea and terrorism, which sort of the 4+1, which have been around for a few years in previous national security strategies, there is a difference in the way China is addressed. Whereas, particularly in 2015, where there's probably a little more interest in finding ways to cooperate, but it calls out China, and notes them as we will challenge them when they do not sort of live up to the principles of the rules-based international order. This document is more confrontational towards China. It treats China more explicitly as it still says competitor, and that's a key choice of words. Right. That point out that America is said to have a strong affinity for a distinction between war and peace, and so that's probably inappropriate. We should be mindful of competition below the level of war, and with that emphasis on competition, China assumes a sort of more negative cast in this document than I think it has in previous ones. Russia certainly treated as an aggressor both in the previous national security strategy in 2015 and this one, and of course Iran and North Korea I think staying in place. But the manner in which those are addressed and the way that competition is framed, so although the threats may look the same at the top level, there is a bit of change in emphasis, which I think matches what's going on in the world, as well as some suggestions as to the ways in which we would participate or engage in that competition and be more confrontational ourselves towards those threats or challengers, competitors.
Does there seem to be a disconnect between the way China and Russia in particular are sort of talked about in this document and the actions coming from the administration so far with regards to Russia and China? I'm not sure that I see them fully in line with each other yet. That perhaps this is sort of saying one thing, but actions are suggesting a different assessment of Russia and China.
Jackie, I'll jump in here. I think you have hit on something important, and that is, what will this national security strategy be, and where does it fit? So, as you identified, it may not be consistent with some of the statements that are coming out of the administration. But if you look at, I think it'll be pretty telling to take a look at the documents that will fall under this umbrella in the future, the National Military Strategy, and look for, are there consistencies there? Are we looking at Russia and China as competitors in those documents as well? And I suspect that we will see that to be the case. And if we view this document as guidance given out to our departments and our agencies on what their approaches should be, then I think it meets the bill in terms of providing them with guidance. So I understand your point about a disconnect perhaps between the rhetoric that is coming out via speeches or Twitter and this document itself.
Well, in that regard, perhaps the most remarkable one was unique, I think, among the national security strategies. This one, Donald Trump gave it's almost like a color commentary with its release. So he gave a speech accompanying it, which previous presidents have not done, where, at least regarding China and Russia, very much dialed back what was said, had quite, wholesome praise for the Russians in particular after his call with President Putin, particularly aiming at areas of terrorism, for instance. But I think if you also look at how it gels together in terms of things like the TPP, it's consistent with the rhetoric of the campaign, clear break with the previous administration. But at the same time, this had been a centerpiece of the American efforts to contain China. China wasn't a part of the TPP. It was largely like-minded democracies and major trading partners setting up a rules-based system. So that one was sort of has handed at least the initiative for East Asian trade to the Chinese. Now, whether that was an intended consequence of that or a clear shift in economic policy, it's not entirely clear, but it's certainly a softer approach than this document would suggest.
Sure. And Michelle, I think your point that this isn't the only document that's going to tell us about national security strategy. We're going to have the national military strategy. Richard, earlier you mentioned the budget. Certainly the defense authorizations and appropriations are deeply important domestic the domestic tax bill, all of these things are going to work together to create, ideally, right, or perhaps work against each other in some cases, to tell the people on the ground who are charged with implementing and executing policy decisions and programs, how they should respond and how they should frame what it is they're doing. And so in my mind, this is one of the most important things that a national security strategy does, is to signal at a political level what the administration's priorities are, how things are going to be framed, and then really where the rubber meets the road is in other places.
No, that's an excellent point. And actually, as I looking at some of the ways and looking at the military section, I found not too much surprising there in terms of the things that they were emphasizing. And some of the language I thought was very, very strong and valuable. You know, when it talked about the manner in which, you know, we need to field enough forces to prevail militarily, consolidate our gains, and achieve our desired political ends. I mean, if that's familiar, for example, I read articles authored by General McMaster before he was the National Security Advisor that made some of these points about, you know, that, and feeding into that issue of making too strong a distinction between peace and war. And if you look at the sort of things they envision for the military, it does sort of capture this idea, and even uses the phrase sort of full spectrum, being able to deal with full spectrum mm-hmm. of conflict. So not limiting ourselves just to conventional war, recognizing the challenges of the past 15 years, Iraq and Afghanistan, and irregular warfare are there. And I think captured in valuable ways in that top level sort of hooks for where we're going to go forward. But in contrast, the one that sort of stood out to me as going to rhetoric reality in terms of what we've seen so far and some of the rhetoric is there's a very fulsome support for diplomacy and its role for the United States and national security, to include a line, you know, we must upgrade our diplomatic capabilities to compete in the current environment and to embrace a competitive mindset. But the information so far coming out of the Department of State is that the focus has been on reducing the size of the force and achieving efficiencies. And although that's efficiencies right. are also mentioned in there, the sense of this enlarged diplomatic role and enhanced in some other ways, but sort of suggests, you know, more emphasis, room for more emphasis and resources for diplomacy that so far haven't been in evidence. That's one that I sort of marked as, I'll be interested to see where those resources or support come from. And by the way, it is connected to one other thing. If I mentioned, you know, that there's still emphasis on leadership, but another word appeared several times in the document that I don't recall seeing very often in the past was catalyze. Sometimes it's not about us mm-hmm. leading, and they put this in the diplomacy section very heavily, but catalyzing what happens in the world, which is often about catalyzing, you know, sort of the American private sector, the global markets, as well as allies and partners and other countries, to sort of achieve things that we're looking for without necessarily the U.S. government.
In a sort of like priming the pump sort of way,
right.
that you can start something in motion and have it continue. And at the same time, though, they're not terribly fond of natural processes. They don't think things are inevitable or. They do require action to make them happen. If I think about this as a professor, as a faculty member, and we've talked about this a little bit, we see sort of maybe the thumbprints or the fingerprints of Trump's national security team, of some enduring concepts from international relations theory or sort of more academic study. And the phrase that sticks out here, and it has before, is this idea of principled realism. Mm. What do we make of that?
I actually read that as sort of a new version of kind of a long-standing American approach to international relations. If there is I think of Kissinger's book Diplomacy has this sense of enduring American or support for both interests and values. That there is a strong values component to the way the United States approaches the world. And although, for practical reasons, and we've said, you know, and particularly when push comes to shove, you know, ultimately we have to defend ourselves, be prepared to operate in a world defined by power, mm-hmm. and that to recognize realistically, and this document has phrasing to that effect, that power has a lot to do with the way the world operates. But that the world is safer, we are safer, and interact better, and in fact it has led to better outcomes when we work well with, or work and live amongst a community of like-minded democracies, and which international relations theory is kind of propagated by the democratic piece. And so there's a sense that you know, we are better off. And that's not a, that's a statement. The theory sort of posits that when certain conditions are in place, that you have liberal democratic institutions, you have norms of liberal democracy, and you have a manner in which those countries connect, sort of Republican cosmopolitanism, I think was the phrase Kant used, that you, that that community actually leads to peace. And that if the closest thing we have to a law in international relations, as one author put it, is that liberal democracies have never gone to war with one another. That this document still sort of endorses that approach, that we'll be better off, we'll have better peaceful relationships with countries that have our values and our principles. So they may not use that, use a different phrasing, but principles and values, and that combination of us, you know, the principled realism is that, yes, we have to be mindful of a world and we have to compete to defend our sovereign interests, but at some level, those principles, those values, what we stand for, heavy on individual rights and liberties and free markets and those sorts of principles are still deeply woven throughout the whole document.
You know, when I read through it, Jackie, I was struck by the fact that it appears there's more to be hopeful in this document than not, as Richard talked about, you know, the calling out of what our American values are, the reminder that for so many portions of the world, America remains a beacon, an example to which they wish to strive.
So again, remains to be seen sort of what the fallout is, how this is implemented, how it nests or doesn't with other national security documents. But for now, I think this is a solid initial take on the national security strategy. So I thank you for your time in reading it carefully, taking lots of notes, and then coming in and sitting down to have this conversation. And we'll look forward to a lot more conversations as we teach it and as we live it in the next few years.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Witt.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.